in Tibet. We can take in the suffering of others and give them back our joy. When we practice a generosity of spirit, we are in many ways practicing all the other pillars of joy. In generosity, there is a wider perspective in which we see our connection to all others. There is a humility that recognizes our place in the world and acknowledges that at another time we could be the one in need, whether that need is material, emotional, or spiritual. There is a sense of humor and an ability to laugh at ourselves so that we do not take ourselves too seriously. There is an acceptance of life in which we do not force life to be other than what it is. There is a forgiveness of others and a release of what might otherwise have been. There is a gratitude for all that we have been given. Finally, we see others with a deep compassion and a desire to help those who are in need. And from this comes a generosity that is wise selfish, a generosity that recognizes helping others as helping ourselves. As the Dalai Lama put it, in fact, taking care of others, helping others, ultimately is the way to discover your own joy and to have a happy life. The time had come for a small surprise party at the Tibetan Children's Village, where 1,750 children, 300 teachers and staff, and another 700 adult guests from the Tibetan community were eagerly waiting to celebrate the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. Like everything we had just read about generosity, we who were there, and all who were watching the live stream around the world, would receive much more from witnessing this extraordinary event than we could ever have hoped to give to the Dalai Lama. Celebration, dancing in the streets of Tibet. As we approached the Tibetan Children's Village, we could feel the excitement of the children even before we could see it in their faces. It was a rare occasion for the Dalai Lama to have time to visit the school, and the fact that he was bringing his honored guest made the event a landmark in the school's history. When we had come in January to plan the trip, we had asked if we could throw a small birthday party for the Dalai Lama. We had met with two of the leaders of the Tibetan children's villages, Sewang Yeshi and Nogadup Wangdu Lingpa, who served as both administrators and surrogate parents for the children, as did all the teachers. They did not want any of the children to miss out on this opportunity, so soon the small gathering had grown to a party of over 2,000. They had kindly offered to bake the birthday cake. We weren't sure how we'd get cake for 2,000 in our luggage. We agreed to bring trick birthday candles from America. The children had been studying how to find joy and happiness in the face of adversity for many months, exploring it in their own lives. They had written about their own wrenching journeys from their families in Tibet, often as young as 5. Many had traveled for weeks with family members or strangers over the snow-covered mountain passes out of Tibet, the same dangerous journey that the Dalai Lama had taken a half-century before. Because an education based in the Tibetan language and culture is suppressed or severely restricted in many parts of the country, their parents, often poor and illiterate farmers themselves, had sent their children to be educated by the Dalai Lama. After delivering them safely, the family members or guides needed to return to Tibet. Often these children would not get to see their families again until they were adults, if ever. As our motorcade approached, we heard the children's soaring voices, their welcoming song high-pitched and plaintive, yet indomitable and joyful. It was a song they had composed for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday. The choir and school staff lined the road. All around them sat waves of students in their school uniforms, the girls in white blouses with green V-neck sweaters and green skirts. The boys wore blue pants and the traditional gray robes over their Tibetan shirts, like the one that had been made for the archbishop. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop's beige SUV drove through the gathered crowd, under the massive circular white tent that had been raised to protect the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop from the midday sun. The car finally arrived at the library, as the children were still singing at the top of their lungs. Once the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were helped out of the car, long katas, the ceremonial white scarves, were put around the Archbishop's neck. They were then ushered over to a ceremonial red box, filled on one side with barley flour mixed with sugar and butter, and on the other side with barley grain. Barley, which is able to grow at high altitudes, is the most important crop in Tibet. The flour, or sampa, that is milled from roasted barley, is a staple of the Tibetan diet. Colorful barley stalks stuck out of the box. A young woman and young man, elaborately dressed in traditional Tibetan clothing, stood next to the box, each of them with their long black hair braided into crowns on their head and large yellow necklaces hanging down to their chests. The young woman held a metal bowl filled with milk, more likely cow or goat than the traditional yak. The Dalai Lama showed the Archbishop how to toss the barley flour into the air and then dip his ring finger into the milk as part of the ceremonial offering. Long yellow, green, and red sticks of incense burned nearby. The crowd of reporters, photographers, security, monks, and officials, including the bearer of the yellow umbrella, thronged around. We were then led into the library, where the librarians placed more scarves on the Archbishop, and the Archbishop began to shrink under the layers of white fabric. I had been told that one of the librarians had spent 3 hours scouring the floor to prepare for their visit. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama walked past the children, who had been selected to share their stories. The children were bowing forward respectfully, holding scarves draped across their hands. The Dalai Lama stopped in front of one of the younger boys, who had a scar running from his nose across his cheek. The Dalai Lama touched it tenderly and asked him how he had gotten the scar, and then showed the boy a scar on his own scalp. As the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama took their seats, a young woman stepped forward. She looked very studious and stylish in her pink metallic glasses. "A very warm good afternoon to you, Your Holiness and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. My name is Tenzin Dolma, and I am from Class 12. Today I'm going to share my experience of my journey from Tibet to India. I was born in a small village called Kartsi in Kham province in Tibet. I am the youngest in my family. My two sisters and I were brought up by our mother, who is a farmer. My oldest memory was of my uncle, who was hiding in our house because the Chinese were looking for him. In 2002, when I was 5 years old, my mother told me to go to India with my grandma. I was very happy because I loved being with my grandma. The journey to India was very long with many difficulties. We had to hide from the Chinese So my grandma... She broke down and started crying, and could not go on. And Pa Tutu stepped forward and put her arm around the girl to comfort her. As she wept, the Dalai Lama said, "Almost every Tibetan family has had a member of their family either killed, or arrested, or tortured." After a few minutes, the girl had recovered and was able to continue. "So my grandmother and I hid under the luggage or under the seat of the bus. At the Nepal border, the Chinese police pushed my grandmother away. We were stuck at the Nepal border for a week. One night, my grandmother told me to go with a Nepalese man to Nepal. I was very afraid, but I went with the stranger. The next day, I reunited with my grandma. When we reached India, we first went to Bodh Gaya for Kala Chakra. Kala Chakra, the Dalai Lama explained, is a big Buddhist ceremony. After that, we came to Dharamsala," she continued. "My grandmother started to cry when she saw His Holiness, and he blessed both of us. And my grandmother then told me who he was. I joined TCV, and my grandmother went back to Tibet. I have not been back to Tibet, and it has been 13 years since I last saw my family. Tenzin was crying again, but still trying to speak. As she cried, I noticed that Jinpo was crying, no doubt moved by her tears, but also perhaps remembering his own early days at a Tibetan boarding school away from his family. The Dalai Lama had the palms of his hands pressed together at his heart. "I was sad to leave my family, but I have found many things that have brought me joy. I have many friends, and I have wonderful teachers, and I have Master Labsong, who is just like my dad." Tenzin was still speaking between tears, her pain spilling over, and I noticed that Nogadup Wangdu, the director of the school, was wiping his eyes with the edge of his gray robe. "And during my last year of school, I remember and thank all those who have worked together and made me what I am today. Without the support of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, there would be no TCV. So I thank you, Your Holiness, from the depth of my heart. Thank you." Tenzin was speaking valiantly through her tears. She stepped back as the next student stepped forward, a younger girl. "Tashi Delek, Your Holiness, Tashi Delek, Desmond Tutu," she began, offering the traditional Tibetan greeting. "First of all, I'd like to say my name is Yongzin Lamo, and I am in Class 8. I came to India in 2007. Today I'm here to share my journey. My journey to India started from Tawo in the Kham province of Tibet. I was only 5, and I had to leave my family behind. The pain I went through leaving my family." Yongzin Lamo stopped and broke down in tears, unable to even start her story. The fact that she had to leave her family was all that really mattered. Impa came back out and put her arm around the young girl to comfort her. After a few minutes of witnessing the girl's tears, with concern in his face, the Dalai Lama began to speak to her. It was clear she was too overcome to continue, and he now stepped into his role as honorary principal and guardian of the school.
"Now, you should think. Here you've got complete freedom and have the opportunity to study. Not only modern education, but also our ancient, thousand-year-old culture. So when you look at your situation that way, you will feel okay. We Tibetans, our population is quite small, around 6 million. But we have a long history, and our own language, and our vast written tradition. So you should feel proud. So then you can feel happy. Now, yes, you can look beyond these sad and difficult experiences. Now you should study hard, because this generation has the responsibility to rebuild Tibet. Then you will feel happy."
The Dalai Lama was trying to help her connect her pain to the larger destiny of the Tibetan people, so she could find meaning and comfort beyond her trauma. "Thank you," the girl said and returned to the embrace of her teachers. A young boy stepped forward in a small gray robe and blue pants. "My name is Tenzin Siring, and I am from Class 7. Now I'm going to share how I escaped from Tibet with my father." As the morning arrived, the moon was still there in the sky. My mother came and told me to study hard and be a brave boy. As soon as my mother was turning away from me, she shed a flood of tears. My father came beside me, patting my back, signaling that it was time for me to say goodbye. I cried my eyes out, not wanting to leave, but my mother insisted that I go, with tears in her eyes. Soon the bus came as we were waiting outside my home. I left my home with a heavy heart, and I stood staring through the window of the bus, capturing all of the beautiful land and people in my heart so that I could recall them whenever I missed my home. As the snow began to cover the road, my friends and I did not give up. We rode on the yak's back, and the elder ones walked in the deep snow of our land. We wore sunglasses to protect our eyes. I saw a bridge awaiting us to come and travel through it. My heart was pounding so hard. We slept throughout the daytime and walked past the Chinese soldiers at night. My sister had serious pain as we were walking. The day passed with walking and hiding. The pain that I went through while coming to India was nothing compared to the pain of leaving my family far behind. Since I left my family, I found no joy in everything I did. I no longer enjoy bus singing, the sight of flowers blooming, the rainbow. The freedom inside me was taken away. I felt myself buried in a deep sorrow with no hope of survival. I was dying slowly inside. The journey to India was the scariest and toughest journey I had ever gone through. My father and I came to Dharamsala, and he took me for shopping and left me in the school, saying that he will come the next day, but he lied to me. I waited for him anxiously, crying every single hour that was passing by. Soon, I got many friends, a loving school and caring teachers, and the blessing of His Holiness. I felt a spot of joy inside me, and I started enjoying my life here in exile. Now I find joy in everything, my loving fellow students, attending classes, and I feel somehow myself again. But I strongly wish to see my mother and to be with her in my own land. That would be the greatest joy of my life. Thank you. The boy bowed forward and walked back to join the other students. There was a long silence as we absorbed the power and pain of the children's stories. Finally, the Dalai Lama turned to the Archbishop.
So you must congratulate them. Their English is better than me?
I must be careful, but yes. They speak very, 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 very well. Beautiful, beautiful. All of them. Even the young ladies, through their pain.
The Archbishop said thank you in English and in Tibetan. Then the Dalai Lama led the Archbishop over to some posters where the children had displayed their pictures and stories about joy. The first one was titled, Joy in Family. And there were others on joy in music and joy in nature. The Dalai Lama read from one of the posters.
I want to hug my parents. There's a deep joy and love in a hug. Very good. Wonderful. I will look after my parents when they grow old. I shall never abandon them. Very nice.
In drawing pictures of what gave them joy, most of the children mentioned their family or their friends and teachers at the school, who had become a second family. More than anything, it was the people they loved who were their greatest source of joy. At the bottom of one of the posters was a quote, "True happiness comes from the joy of deeds well done, the zest of creating things new." It was a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the author of The Little Prince, a story about another boy who was far away from his home. As we left the library, the girls' choir began singing the birthday song again, this time accompanied by a Tibetan lute. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were led to two chairs at the center of the enormous tent, which displayed the endless knot and other Tibetan symbols overhead. Around the tent hung red, green, and yellow fringes, and strung all along the edges of it were red, green, yellow, white, and blue prayer flags. The almost 2,000 children, who had been waiting patiently, were then invited to stand and sing the Tibetan version of If You're Happy and You Know It, which involved shaking their heads, clapping their hands, wiggling their hips, and stamping their feet. Around the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop spread a carpet of cross-legged children. They ranged from 5 to 18 years old, from kindergarten to grade 12. Behind them was a group of adults that had somehow found out about the event. One was patriotically waving a South African flag. Then the Dalai Lama took the headset and began to address the students, but then turned to his friend.
Since you often describe my English as very poor, now I am going to speak Tibetan.
The Dalai Lama slapped the Archbishop's arm playfully, and the Archbishop pretended to rub it as if wounded. The kids were giggling as the two grown-ups, now reconciled, took each other's hands.
So, Archbishop Desmond Tutu is one of my closest friends on this earth. The Archbishop also has been supporting the Tibetan cause unflinchingly. You are a generation whose parents have suffered, and you also have suffered to be able to come here. And, as Tibetans, the Indian government has helped us since the beginning of our exile. Other organizations from all parts of the world have helped us. And because of their kindness and compassion, you have the opportunity to study here. And so you should really work hard in your studies. We are going through a very difficult period in our history, but we have such a rich culture and language. So whether you are monastics or lay people, you should take great interest in preserving and promoting this culture through education. Our culture should not just be in a museum. All around the world, people are facing lots of difficulties, and our culture can help the world. Today, the main guest is Archbishop Tutu, and not me.
The Archbishop put on his headset microphone, which had a little wire along his cheek and fit snugly around his ears. He laughed as his microphone was being adjusted.
I look like Bono now, don't I? Your Holiness, and all of you very, very beautiful children. Some of you are not really children. It is such a great, great honor and privilege to be here. All of us are very, 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 very proud and privileged to be here in Dharamsala.
The Archbishop turned to the Dalai Lama.
You are beloved throughout the world.
He then turned back to the attentive faces of the children.
And we want to say to you, young people especially, it might not seem possible that you will one day return to a free Tibet. We in South Africa, for many, many years, lived under a system of injustice and oppression. And many, many of our leaders and people, young people, went into exile. And it seemed like the chains of oppression would never be broken. That our leaders who were on Robben Island, the prison, would never come home alive. But yow! But it happened. It happened. In 1990, our beloved Nelson Mandela and others were released from prison. And the exiles came back home.
The Archbishop stretched out his arms as if in an embrace to welcome them home. Then he spoke with the force of righteousness, and was transformed into the prophet that he had been in South Africa, seer of the future, willing it with his words.
One day you too, all of you, will see your beloved Tibet. You will be free from the oppression that has driven you to here. The Chinese government will discover that freedom is actually cheaper than oppression. I am very deeply honored to be the friend of the Dalai Lama. I show off when I'm in other places. I pretend that I am modest and don't tell too many people that actually he is a very, very dear friend. I just say, well, you know, he's mischievous. He's troublesome. When I'm wearing my cap, he takes it off my head and puts it on his own. You know what? The world supports you. The world loves the Dalai Lama. I also want to add my thank you to the Indian government, the Indian people who opened their arms to welcome you, because they have preserved for us a great treasure. They preserve for us a great treasure that would otherwise have been lost. And so I want to say to you, all of you, oh, look at how beautiful you are. Oh, yo, 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 ho, ho, ho. One day, you will be dancing and singing in the streets of Tibet, your home country. God bless you.
The children now cheered even louder. They were trying to be polite and respectful, but you could see how their hope had been awakened. I scanned the faces of the children, from the older boys and girls who were really almost young men and women, the next generation of Tibetan leaders, down to the very young children whose memories of leaving their families must still be fresh, the wounds of separation still healing. I felt like my heart was in my throat. Tears streamed down my cheeks as I recalled the anguish we had just witnessed in the library, imagining the children's equally broken-hearted parents. It was not hard to imagine what dancing in the streets of Tibet, reunited with their families, would mean to them. everything. After a few questions from the older students, a huge multi-layered cake with our trick candles burning was brought onto the stage. At the same time, teachers began to pass out little square pieces of cake to all the students. It was an ingenious way to distribute the cake, since we would have been there all day if we had to cut each child a slice. A group of older children took the stage. This time a band of boys played guitars and drums as the chorus of girls began to sing, "We Are the World." Soon the whole school was singing with them. "We are the world. We are the children. We are the ones who make a brighter day, so let's start giving." They waved their arms above their heads together as the Archbishop got up to dance his irrepressible elbow-waving boogie. He encouraged the Dalai Lama to get up and dance. As a Tibetan Buddhist monk, the Dalai Lama's vows prohibit dancing, but today he got up to dance for the first time in his life. He started to sway and rock his hands back and forth. At first, as uncomfortable as a middle school boy on the dance floor, the Dalai Lama started to smile and laugh as the Archbishop encouraged him. They took each other's hands and moved to the music, celebrating the true joy of friendship, the true joy of our unbreakable connection to one another, the true joy of the world coming together as one. Behind them, sewn into the tent, were two Tibetan endless knots, symbols for the impermanence and interdependence of all life, and the union of wisdom and compassion. Between the knots was an image of two golden fish with large eyes, which represents sentient beings crossing the ocean of existence with a clear sight of wisdom, as well as the fearlessness of not drowning in the ocean of suffering. The song finished, and then the Archbishop began to sing, forcing his usual tenor into a deep and resonant bass.
"Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Your Holiness. Happy birthday to you."
This was followed by "Happy Birthday" sung in Tibetan, as the Dalai Lama tried to wave out the candles, which had by now burned down so low that the cake was starting to catch fire. The Archbishop encouraged him not to put out the small fire that was starting to burn on top of the cake, but to blow it out properly.
"Wait, wait, can we have one or two of the children help us blow out the candles? There we go."
Two little girls, one in her school uniform and an even younger and tinier one in pigtails and a green dress, were raised onto the stage between them.
"One, two, three."
They blew out the candles, but then the trick candles relit. The Archbishop let out a cackle as they blew again, and then the flames came back. But on the third time, as the Archbishop laughed, the Dalai Lama and the girls kept blowing until they finally blew the candles out. The children were led in a prayer of offering as they held their pieces of cake up high in both hands, giving thanks for their teachers, their teachings, and their community, and perhaps for the opportunity to someday see their families again. Departure. A final goodbye. The next morning was a brief final session. We had to head to the airport early to fly the Archbishop to yet another funeral of one of his dear friends. So many of the greats were leaving us. We sat back in the warm pool of light that had enveloped us all week and got our mics connected. I thought about how the Archbishop was in his 80s, and how the Dalai Lama was joining him in this ninth decade of life. We were all reflecting on the birthday celebration the day before at the school, and how these two elders had shared their hard-won wisdom with the students and found hope in the next generation. We all receive a transmission from our role models and mentors, and we all pass it along to those who come after. This was the goal of our project together. I was sitting across from the Archbishop and was staring at his beautiful, loving face, which had become so familiar over the last decade of collaboration and friendship. He has become a second father and a beloved mentor. I thought of his battle with prostate cancer and how slow the cancer had been to respond to the last round of experimental drugs. We were worried about how long we would have with him. Not just all those who knew and loved him, but the world that still needed him and his moral voice. The Archbishop's ability to travel had been severely restricted by his doctors, and he had at one time said he was not going to travel outside of South Africa again. This made his decision to come to Dharamsala all the more extraordinary and unlikely to be repeated. Because the South African government would not grant the Dalai Lama a visa, we all knew, most especially the two of them, that this trip might be their last time together. Death, as the Archbishop had reminded us, is inevitable. It is the way life should be. A beginning, a middle, and an end. It is this cycle that makes life precious and beautiful. However, it does not make the sorrow any less for those who lose one they love. The Archbishop asked me why I was looking so solemn. "I'm reflecting," I said, "on our time coming to a close."
"Everything has an end."
After the Archbishop's customary prayer, we began our discussion for the last time. "Archbishop, Your Holiness, what an incredible joy and privilege it has been to join you in this conversation to prepare the Book of Joy. Today is just for a few final questions. One we received was, why do you think it is important to write the Book of Joy now? And what do you hope it will do for readers and listeners around the world?"
"You obviously hope that you could be an agent for helping God's children enter into their heritage, so they can have greater fulfillment and can become all that they are meant to be. And you hope that they will realize that it will happen most of all if they are generous, if they are compassionate, if they are caring. It is when, without thinking about it, you help someone who is less well off, when you are kind to someone else, and do those things that raise others up, you end up being joyful."
The day before, at the Tibetan Children's Village, the Archbishop had answered one of the children's questions by saying,
"If we think we want to get joy for ourselves, we realize that it's very short-sighted, short-lived. Joy is the reward, really, of seeking to give joy to others. When you show compassion, when you show caring, when you show love to others, do things for others, in a wonderful way, you have a deep joy that you can get in no other way. You can't buy it with money. You can be the richest person on earth. But if you care only about yourself, I can bet my bottom dollar you will not be happy and joyful. But when you are caring, compassionate, more concerned about the welfare of others than about your own, wonderfully, wonderfully, you suddenly feel a warm glow in your heart, because you have, in fact, wiped the tears from the eyes of another."
Now he addressed the second part of my question.
"Why now? I think that there is so much that is hurting. You almost want not to read the newspaper or watch television when, if you are going to watch television, you will see the beheading of someone's child. When you see the number of refugees, mothers running away from one source of violence and pulling children behind them. Even when you live comfortably, it clutches at your heartstrings. It's very distressing, particularly when we think that during the time of our struggle against apartheid, our people were refugees and exiled and were welcomed into African countries that were a great deal less well off than South Africa is. You have to be quite careless not to be sad. We look like we are hell-bent on competing to show who will be the most exquisitely cruel. I think God wants us to be joyful at every time, but right now, I think God is crying quite a lot."
The Archbishop was gesturing to the Dalai Lama.
"It's your turn now.
This is our last session, so perhaps I will state it this way. I am one human being born in Amdo Province in northeast Tibet, in a very, very small village in 1935. So at that time, the Sino-Japanese conflict was about to start. Soon after, the Second World War began, then the Korean War, then the Vietnam War. Because of these wars, there was immense violence. At those times, the human mind, or at least those who were responsible for going to war, believed that using force was the best method for solving disagreement. During the Second World War, for example, when a nation declared war on another, the citizens of the country proudly joined the war effort without the slightest question. But since the Vietnam War, our way of thinking has changed. More and more people now publicly oppose war. We saw this opposition to war in Kosovo, in Iraq. Many people were against these wars, and from Australia to America, people openly protested against these wars. This is truly a hopeful sign. I think as long as we human beings remain here, there will always be some limited violence, as there is with all animals. But serious violence, mass killing, war, this we can eliminate if we have the proper vision and method. I think, certainly, it is possible to achieve a world without such sorrow.
At the Tibetan Children's Village, in response to the question of whether joy can be the ultimate source of world peace, the Dalai Lama had responded,
I think so. I think, firstly, people should have a clear understanding of joyfulness. You see, you might get a temporary joy in killing your enemy or bullying someone. You may get some kind of temporary satisfaction. But the true joyfulness comes from helping others. This way you get much more satisfaction. So that kind of thinking about joyfulness is really an important factor in building a happy society, peaceful society. In order to create peaceful family, first, the individual person himself or herself should create inner peace, joyfulness, then share with other family members. In that way, one family, 10 families, 100 families, that way, we can change and bring happier community, happier society, then happier humanity. 7 billion human beings, we all have same desire, same right to achieve happy life.
The Dalai Lama then returned to the topic of why he wanted to write the Book of Joy, and why now.
We are learning. In 1996, I had an audience with the late Queen Mother. At that time, she was 96 years old. Since my childhood, I have seen pictures of her round face, so she was quite familiar, and I was really looking forward to the meeting. I asked her, since you have observed almost the whole 20th century, do you feel the world is becoming better, worse, or staying the same? Without hesitation, she answered, better. When she was young, she said, there was no concept of human rights or the right to self-determination. Now, these things have become universal. She shared these two examples of how the world is getting better. I think the majority of people everywhere believe that bloodshed is not good and have a desire for peace. Around the time of my meeting with the Queen Mother, I also had a conversation with the renowned quantum physicist Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, who was the brother of the then West German president. Von Weizsäcker, too, argued that the world was improving. For example, he said that in the past, every German felt that the French were his enemy, and every French felt that the Germans were his enemy. Now, these archenemies have joined together and have formed the Franco-German Unified Force. They have also been key players in the formation of the European Union. It is not perfect, but it is progress. So then eventually, the Berlin Wall disappeared, not by force, but by popular movement. So you see change. Now, China is also changing, Cuba is also changing. North Korea alone, perhaps, has not changed. Yet. So these things are positive signs. Human beings, through wider contact and more education, are becoming more mature. It takes time, and we must take the long view. When we look at our world with a longer time frame, say, of 100 years, we can then envision a world that is very different, a better, kinder, a more equitable, more joyful world. But we must start the process of that change now, not wait for some ideal time. The ideal time is now.
The Dalai Lama was arguing for this longer perspective, and I could not help but think of Sir Martin Rees's comment that we were only halfway through our evolution as a species on this planet. When one thinks of the long parade of the human journey, it is really quite extraordinary to think what we can become in a century, in a millennium, or more.
After meeting with so many people, thinkers, scientists, educators, healthcare professionals, social workers, and activists, it is clear that the only way to truly change our world is through teaching compassion. Our society is lacking an adequate sense of compassion, sense of kindness, and genuine regard for others' well-being. So now many, many people who seriously think about humanity all have the same view. We must promote basic human values, the inner values that lie at the heart of who we are as humans. Religion is not sufficient. Religion has been very important in human history, and perhaps for another 1,000 years it will continue to bring benefit to humanity.
The Dalai Lama knew he was being controversial, calling the long-term value of religion into question, and he had taken the Archbishop's hand to comfort him and reaffirm that he was not planning to put either of them out of a job anytime soon.
So now we have to think seriously. Just to pray or rely on religious faith is not sufficient. It will remain a source of inspiration, but in terms of 7 billion human beings, it is not sufficient. No matter how excellent, no religion can be universal. So we have to find another way to promote these values. I think the only way really is, as we have said, through education. Education is universal. We must teach people, especially our youth, the source of happiness and satisfaction. We must teach them that the ultimate source of happiness is within themselves, not machine, not technology, not money, not power. We are not talking about heaven or hell or Buddhahood or salvation. These are too far away. So our book is part of this important process to help spread the message that love, kindness, and affection are the source of joy and happiness. As you already made clear, our basic human nature is good, is positive, so that can give us a basis for courage and self-confidence. So that's why we spend a lot of time discussing all of this. There must be some real concrete purpose and result, or if not, it's better to sleep.
The Dalai Lama pretended to lean over on his elbow toward the Archbishop, as if falling asleep, and then laughed. I turned to Archbishop Tutu and said, I'd like to invite you, Archbishop, to address your listeners directly and offer them a blessing. He turned to the camera and began to speak.
Dear child of God, you are loved with a love that nothing can shake, a love that loved you long before you were created, a love that will be there long after everything has disappeared. You are precious, with a preciousness that is totally quite immeasurable. And God wants you to be like God, filled with life and goodness and laughter and joy. God, who is forever pouring out God's whole being from all eternity, wants you to flourish, God wants you to be filled with joy and excitement, and ever longing to be able to find what is so beautiful in God's creation. The compassion of so many, the caring, the sharing. And God says, please, my child, help me. Help me to spread love and laughter and joy and compassion. And you know what, my child? As you do this, hey presto, you discover joy. Joy, which you had not sought, comes as the gift, as almost the reward for this non-self-regarding caring for others.
Thank you. Your Holiness, what final words would you like to leave the listener with so that they can experience more joy and create more joy in our world?
I hope this book will leave you with more hope and a sense of greater responsibility, rooted in genuine concern for others' well-being. You see, in order to become a happy person, we need to live more from the compassionate part of our nature and to have a sense of responsibility toward others and the world we live in. In this century, if we make an attempt with realistic effort and clear vision, perhaps in the latter part of the century, we can really have a happier world, a more peaceful world, a kinder and more compassionate world. So, my hope is that this book can be a contribution toward bringing about this happier humanity. Nobody expects this book alone will change the world. No, that's impossible. But from various quarters, with a common effort and a vision that thinks about humanity, we can achieve unity and harmony with a sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, with the oneness of humanity. And all these small problems here and there, I think, ultimately, we will solve. But we must also address the bigger problems. When the larger systemic problems are addressed, then the small problems will also be solved quite easily. So all of us, spiritual brothers and sisters, have a special responsibility, have a special role to make clear that the ultimate source of a meaningful life is within ourselves. If you live in this way, until your last breath comes, you will be a happy, happy person. That's the goal of human life, to live with joy and purpose.
We were done with the interviews, but before we ended the session, the Archbishop thanked all who had been involved, most especially his friend.
I want to say a very big thank you to the Dalai Lama for his generosity and his hospitality here. Thank you very, very much for opening your home so we could come and be cared for and have this very important project undertaken. Would you please tell your household and staff that we are very deeply indebted to them?
He then turned to me.
Now you can say your piece.
Actually, I think you said it so wonderfully, which is to thank each and every one for the incredible work of making these dialogues possible. But as a representative of all those who will benefit from this work, I want to thank you both so profoundly for your life-sustaining and life-changing words. May the merit of this book benefit all of God's children and all sentient beings. As we got ready to leave, the Dalai Lama turned to the Archbishop.
I was very sad to miss your birthday. When I found out that you might come here, I was really surprised. I knew your health was not good, and that you were also very old, and to reach here is not easy.
Yes, that's quite right.
But when I heard that everything was finalized, and the date and hour was approaching, I really felt happy and excited. I really appreciate your friendship and your sense of responsibility to do what you can for a better humanity.
Earlier in the week, the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama had reflected on what was so special about their friendship, with characteristic humor.
He's always teasing me. Almost the first time we met, do you remember? Maybe the first time you were a little reserved, but by the second time, You were taking my cap off my head. I don't know that you wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to become a friend to the Dalai Lama. It just happens. Scientists will come afterward and analyze it, but I don't think that he woke up either, at 3, and said, I think I'm going to be friends with that large-nosed black man from Africa. I think it was a communication of the heart. When we kept quiet, our hearts discovered that they were kindred spirits. I admire him enormously. Oh, he's going to get proud. But I always say to people, after being in exile over 50 years, how many would show the same serenity, the same joy, and the eagerness to spread goodness and compassion in the world? I think I would be very sulky, and I think there'd be a part of me that was always sad, and it would show in my face. It doesn't in his. I mean, I'm just saying he is there for us as a beacon to tell us that you can, in fact, overcome some of the most horrendous circumstances and emerge on the other side, not broken. So he is a very great gift to the world. And maybe the Chinese, without intending it, have given the world a wonderful gift.
Thank you.
The Dalai Lama said it quietly, perhaps humbled by the praise.
Pay me, pay me.
The Archbishop put out his hand and rubbed his fingertips together.
I will pay with a few nice words. At our first meeting, I noticed this person. I always look at people. Firstly, human level. So I do not consider importance of their rank or position. So, on the human level, this person is very nice, humble. I think very, very, very joyful. And then, you see, once you connect on the human level, you become close friends, and that friendship never changes. But on another level, this person is a very funny person. I love that. He is always teasing me, and also I am teasing him. So we really become something quite special. And finally, right from the beginning, you always speak out about the truth and the justice of the Tibetan cause. As a Tibetan, I very much appreciate it. Whenever he is at Nobel Peace Prize laureate meetings, they are full of joy. The atmosphere is something different. Then in recent years, because of his age and also his physical condition, you see, he could not attend. Of course, there are many other Nobel Peace Prize laureates, and many other Nobel Peace Prize laureates are wonderful ladies.
You are a monk, remember?
But when you are not there, something is missing. Really, really, really. The other Nobel Peace Prize laureates also feel it, I think. So the relationship is something unique and something very special.
Thank you. I paid him.
The Dalai Lama erupted into a belly laugh and then began pointing at the Archbishop.
His face, his face. He looks like a monk now, doesn't he?
The Dalai Lama drew his hand into the shape of an eye, and then he squeezed the Archbishop's nose playfully.
When I see your eyes, and of course your nose.
The Archbishop could not help but giggle at the mention of his much joked about nose. Then the Dalai Lama's playful tone changed as he pointed at the Archbishop's face warmly.
This picture, special picture, I think, at time of my death, I will remember you.
I could hear everyone in the room, even the camera operators, take a deep breath. We were all so moved. The Archbishop looked down and hummed deeply, obviously humbled and touched by the Dalai Lama's words. Could there be a truer sign of love to see another's face at the time of death?
Thank you. Thank you.
It was all the Archbishop could say, all that could be said.
So perhaps, according to your religious tradition, we may meet in heaven in the presence of God. You, as a good Christian practitioner, will go first?
The Archbishop now chuckled heartily, and the room seemed to breathe again.
You may help me and bring us together.
We laughed, imagining the Archbishop bargaining with St. Peter at the pearly gates, trying to get special admission for the Dalai Lama.
But from the Buddhist viewpoint, once in a life, you develop some sort of special close connection. Then that sort of impact will carry life after life. That's Buddhist viewpoint. So maybe even then. But now, I'm looking forward to another occasion to see you again. Somewhere that only God knows.
After some final photographs were taken, we had to rush to the airport. As the Archbishop leaned on his cane now, walking perhaps a bit slower than before, his age showing just a little more than it had earlier in the week, I could see the Dalai Lama's forehead wrinkling with concern and worry. He had said God only knew where they would meet again, and perhaps he was thinking about whether God would give them another opportunity in this life. The two leaders had told us over the course of the week that there is no joy without sorrow, that in fact it is the pain, the suffering, that allows us to experience and appreciate the joy. Indeed, the more we turn toward the suffering, our own and others, the more we can turn toward the joy. We accept them both, turning the volume of life up, or we turn our backs on life itself, becoming deaf to its music. They had also told us and demonstrated that true joy is a way of being, not a fleeting emotion. What they had cultivated in their long lives was that enduring trait of joyfulness. They had warned us that we cannot pursue joy as an end in itself, or we will miss the bus. Joy comes, rather, from daily thoughts, feelings, and actions. And they had told us repeatedly the action that gets us on the bus, bringing joy to others. At the car, the two old mischievous friends were joking and laughing again. The Dalai Lama was rubbing the Archbishop's hand tenderly through the open window of the car. I could still see the signs of worry, or perhaps it was just sadness, at saying goodbye. As the engine started to hum, the Dalai Lama looked at the Archbishop in the car, staying with him to the last minutes of his visit. He put the palms of his hands together in front of his face and bowed his head forward in a sign of deep respect and affection. The motorcade to the airport began to move, and the Dalai Lama still stood, bowed slightly forward, eyes twinkling, and fingers waving goodbye brightly, as children do. As we drove away, the Archbishop looked back through the window of the SUV and gave one last smile and laugh to his improbable and invaluable friend. The next day, the rest of the film crew flew out of the airport in Dharamsala on a clear day. 45 seconds after their plane took off, an enormous 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck in Nepal. The devastation was enormous, and the tremors were felt all the way in Dharamsala. We thought of all the people we knew and cared for in the region, and we mourned the thousands who had died. We witnessed as people from all around the world poured in to help the displaced, repair the broken, and heal the thousands who were wounded. It was hard not to think of the Dalai Lama's comment on the first day of the dialogues, that the suffering of natural disasters we cannot stop. But so much of the rest of our suffering we can. Adversity, illness, and death are real and inevitable. We choose whether to add to these unavoidable facts of life with a suffering we create in our own minds and hearts, the chosen suffering. The more we make a different choice to heal our own suffering, the more we can turn to others and help to address their suffering with the laughter-filled, tear-stained eyes of the heart. And the more we turn away from our own self-regard to wipe the tears from the eyes of another, the more, incredibly, we are able to bear, to heal, and to transcend our own suffering. This was their true secret to joy. Joy practices. During the week, as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop joked about who got up too early and who was praying and meditating too much, it was clear that both believed strongly that spiritual practices were the essential ground of their being, sustaining and supporting them through their lives. These daily times of prayer and meditation kept these two masters in spiritual alignment. I thought about what the Archbishop had said about the even greater importance of these practices for those who are not spiritual teachers, but who must live and die in the blur and buzz of the marketplace. During the week, we had had a chance to discuss some of the spiritual practices that help to cultivate and sustain their joy. In this section, we present some simple practices that can help overcome the obstacles to joy and support the eight pillars of joy. We have bookended this section with practices that Tibetan Buddhist monks typically do at the beginning and end of each day. The other practices can be tried on a regular basis or when needed. Like physical exercises, spiritual practices are not ends in themselves. They exist to support our mental health and mental immunity. The more we practice, the more we benefit. There is no spiritual competition. Do whatever you need to adapt them to your life for maximum benefit. Remember the Dalai Lama adapting his morning practice to accommodate his aging knees. As the Dalai Lama said, he finds the science very motivating when he is trying to decide whether to wake up or hit the snooze button. Earlier, we mentioned Daniel Siegel's explanation of the brain on meditation. It seems that we are literally using our attention and awareness to establish neural firing patterns that help the brain avoid the destructive reactivity that the Dalai Lama said was so toxic to our mental and physical health. Many of these practices appear to integrate and harmonize the brain so that we can respond to the inevitable challenges of life with less fragmentation and more integration, less fear and anger, and more ease and joy. In our age of instant gratification, any information can be Googled in a matter of seconds, but real knowledge and wisdom take time. These practices reward and deepen through continued effort. Usually when we start meditating or praying, we can experience what the Archbishop has called spiritual sweets, or the tingling and calming that comes from beginning to pay attention to our inner life. Like sweets, these are tasty, but the real benefits occur as we create a temporal container into which we can pour our heart and soul as we experience the joys and sorrows of life. The nature of contemplative life is that it is very personal, and not all practices will work for all people. Find what works best for you. What is presented here are simply sample practices, including many that the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop use. We hope these will inspire your own practice. Morning intention setting. Every conscious action begins with intention, which is simply setting goals. Many Tibetan monks do this each morning as a way of preparing their mind and heart for how they wish to face the day. They also check in with their intentions regularly when preparing to sit in meditation or when undertaking any important task. Another way to focus your intentions is to read short inspirational passages that support your highest ideals. The Archbishop celebrates the Eucharist each morning, which involves reading and pondering biblical passages. He observes the liturgies of the hours, morning, noonday, and evening prayer, for which there are a cycle of designated readings. He also likes to read passages from the great mystics to guide his heart and mind.
1. Sit comfortably, either on a chair with the soles of your feet on the ground or cross-legged. You can also do this exercise while still lying in bed before getting up in the morning, after the alarm goes off, and before the rush of day has begun. You can rest your hands on your legs or on your belly. 2. Close your eyes and take several long breaths through your nose. Feel your stomach rise and fall as you breathe through your diaphragm. 3. Now ask yourself, what is my heart's desire? What do I wish for myself, for my loved ones, and for the world? Our deepest desires usually lie beyond our temporary wishes and wants. They are likely to involve living with profound human values that lead to our greatest happiness, calling us back to our place within the fabric of life.
There is a simple way of testing our intentions.
Is it just for me, or for others? For the benefit of the few, or for the many? For now, or for the future? This litmus test can help guide us toward what we truly wish for. 4. Then state your intention for the day. For example, today, may I greet everyone with the love that is in my heart. Or, today, may I be less judgmental. Or, today, may I be patient and loving with my children. It can be specific, or it can be general. If you do not know your intention, you can repeat the following 4 lines adapted from the traditional Tibetan prayer of the 4 Immeasurables, which has guided many on their journey to more compassion and greater happiness. May all beings attain happiness. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings never be separated from joy. May all beings abide in equanimity.
Overcoming the obstacles to joy. Focus and stress relief, a breathing practice. Our breath is so important as a focus of spiritual practice in many religious traditions because it is the hinge between ourself and the world. Our breath is internal, but it is also external. Breath is also both voluntary and involuntary. It is therefore an ideal doorway through which we can develop our self-cultivation. Focus, as you may remember, is so important that neuroscientist Richard Davidson found that one of the 4 neural circuits of well-being was dedicated to our ability to focus the mind. Simply observing quiet time, which the Archbishop maintains in the pre-dawn hours, afternoon, and evening, is another way to focus our mind, relieve stress, and concentrate on what matters most.
1. Find a quiet place where you can practice consistently. This way, the physical space, a room, a corner, a cushion, will help signal to your body that this is a time for your practice. 2. Sit comfortably. If you are sitting on a cushion or a chair, try to lean slightly forward, away from the back of the chair, so that your back will be straight. If you have chronic back pain, adjust as necessary. 3. Close your eyes or keep them slightly open in a restful position. 4. Place your hands gently on your knees or in your lap. 5. Focus your attention on your breath. 6. Breathe in deeply through your nose as your belly expands. As a jug of water fills from the bottom, your lungs should also fill from